I should do one on Hans-Georg Gadamer, who is on the one, many different things, actually. He lives from 1900 through to, I think, 2002. So he has this really long life that spans all these different movements in the 20th century. And he himself comes out of traditions of, many different traditions, traditions of classics and the reading of older texts. So he's very much involved in what it means to read texts from different times and cultures and try and understand them. In a sense, you can see him as part of that whole tradition of classics, Oriental studies, text and historical understanding. He moves in his youth into philosophy. So he's very much there at the moment in which 20th century phenomenology explodes. He studies under Husserl, Heidegger, and other phenomenologists as well, like Max Scheler, and is involved in that big philosophical movement in Germany in the sort of 20s, 30s, into the 40s to redefine the nature of human experience, what we call reality, and what we call truth. Right, so he's from dealing with actual text, he moves into this area of sort of philosophical engagement with the nature of meaning. And over time, he also becomes in broader ethical questions. So he starts to write about the nature, not only of truth, but of understanding as a kind of a human social process, what it means to understand, to respect the other, to comprehend correctly, or indeed other ways of understanding. Understanding becomes a very limited notion, but also what it means to comprehend in such a way that you're creating new ideas, you're seeing new truths, you're affected, you're influenced, you're sort of experiencing a range of different forms of response to language and communication. Really, it's the emergence of ideas in lots of different forms. And that takes him into the ethics of society, the ethics of science, the ethics of poetry, or the nature of happy, healthy human life. He talks about education, about literally the medical establishment and its understandings of health, and other areas as well. So he, from this kind of central focus on trying to understand what our experiences of truth are, through a range of different perspectives. And he reads also theological hermeneutics. He reads lots of poetry and literary hermeneutics. From that central concern to understand truth, he ends up with a whole larger vision of reality. And Gadamer isn't always understood to have done quite so much. He's mostly associated with a particular idea that's really central to the 20th century. As we'll see in a moment, he's involved in the debate that says there is no solid truth. If there is no solid truth, what shall we do? How shall we proceed? Different cultures have different truths. Different people have different truths. How do we ever understand each other? Is there any such thing as truth? That idea and the debate that sort of rises around it. Yes, there's truth. No, there's not truth. Yes, there's an outside world, which is what truth is talking about. No, we can never get to the outside world that truth is talking about. Yes, everything is solid. No, everything is fluid and personal and subjective. Those two competing perspectives become very powerful in the 20th century. I think there's a real fear that if we lose a grasp on truth, then things will go badly wrong. Analytic philosophy is very concerned about this, as are other fields. And this kind of ties in with the rise of science as a arbiter of truth, science and technology. Gadamer writes in his own sort of autobiographical reflections, growing up in the early 20th century, in parts of Germany, Prussia at the time, that were technologically very advanced, actually. He writes about what it is to see more and more cars, more and more street lights, technology winning out and transforming the world. He says that's very exciting, but it gives scientific ideas of truth, fact, right and wrong, a certain preeminence over other ideas of truth which get forgotten. So things like poetry, for instance, poetic truths, and just self-expressive truths in the arts, and other kinds of truth as well. And all of this is important when you apply it to the idea that science takes over not only different kinds of discourse, but also different parts of human life. So spirituality gets covered up by science. Personal, rich psychological self-expression gets covered up by kind of science. Mm. And indeed, kind of what happens when you really just talk to somebody, also gets covered up by science notions, scientific notions of assertive fact. We talk to someone, we engage with them, and a strange, complex play happens where ideas are exchanged. You know sort of what the person means, but you're not sure. You're relating it to your own experience. You're offering them back an interpretation of what they just said that sparks off something in them and creates a new meaning. And they play through that and suggest different things coming from it. And that back and forth, quite creative interplay of ideas, is what it is for humans to interact and be excited and changed by that. And he says we start to forget that as time goes on. So Gadamer's ideas address that shift in different kinds of truth and different kinds of experience, actually. And he becomes famous for his ideas in Truth and Method, in which he suggests that we need to change our view of truth. And seems to, for many people, he solves the problem of relativism, right? Which he ends that debate by, in this very long, very meandering book, actually, underneath at the heart of it, explaining that truth can be relative to different contexts and different people, but that does not mean that there is no central theme that is effectively still the core of what a conversation is. So it can be the case that you have your own interpretation, and I have my own interpretation. But when we talk together, if we want to have a conversation, you can't simply introduce a completely random association out of your life. I mean, you can, but it will only create a conversation in you. It won't be something that I can then respond to in a way that sort of carries on the coherence of the themes that we've been talking about. You can introduce things which are subtly new, and my own thinking will change, the conversation will grow in a certain direction. But in fact, it is the case that there is a consistency and coherence and sort of thematic core to truths, to conversations, to communications and understanding, that you can't go too far beyond without the conversation ending.
Does this apply to the rules of language, mm-hmm. as, you know, grammar and mm-hmm. things like this?
To a large extent, I think that's right, yeah. So it could, you can see it on the small scale. You know, yeah. I say, I'm going to the shops, and then I say, I'm going to blue. And you mean, blue? Is blue an object, a place? Yeah. I'm like, no, the colour blue. And you say, no, the colour blue isn't a place you can go to. And I go, oh, you're quite right. I contravene the rules of language.
Yes.
So the conversation will not function anymore. You know, it's not... So He's stopping before Derrida and saying, I can't just play wildly into the furthest reaches of language and still have a functioning conversation. But he is reminding us that the consistency and coherence and the anchor of truth, that conversation, is something real. It's something I can't get away from, right? It's relative to each conversation. So each new person I talk to, the rules will be a little bit different. Each new language I speak in, the rules will be a bit different. Each new culture, each new kind of conversation. You know, am I trying to inspire and encourage someone? Am I trying to explain and convey some information? Each context will alter those rules. So it's relative in the sense that truth is context dependent, but it is also very much fixed in the sense that once I'm part of those rules, I have to work with them. And working against them means that the activity I'm engaged in of communication, understanding, etc., will cease. And that's okay. It becomes a different kind of activity. It's in my own head. But truth as a interaction between two different contexts can only happen in respect of those rules. So that's kind of, I'll come back to that, but that's kind of the core idea with which he counters and ends this debate between what you might call relativism and objectivism, right? After this, people are able to say, okay, I can continue trying to understand other cultures, and I acknowledge that my interpretation of whatever, the Quran, the Upanishads, will always be relative to my context, right? It's this conversation between me and it. But it's also the case that as long as I'm maintaining the conversation and the other side, the text or the other community, gets to keep checking me, then I will have to be maintaining a relationship to its truth. So I don't get to run away with the Quran. I don't get to run away with the Upanishads or with the Bible. I can run away if I'm creating new poetry, because then it's a different kind of text. But if I want to maintain a truth in relation to the original source, I have to keep engaging with it. And it becomes the limit case, the test case, if you like, the boundary for the new truths that I create and come up with, the new associations and ideas that I use to engage with it. So I'll come back to this idea, but this is kind of the approach that that's the center of what he seemed to have added. And what I'm doing in this particular session is just reading through some sections for the first chapters that will be in the book. The book will be called Gadamer on Religion, Exploring Religious Worlds. And this is the section that is on text. So in a way, we're starting with the area which he's most firmly associated with. And in later sessions, I'll be looking at how he rethinks the nature of spirituality, how he rethinks the nature of the self, how he rethinks the notion of pluralistic, multicultural community, how he rethinks the relationship between science and religion, and indeed also rethinks the nature of God. So we've got different sort of key themes. So I'm going to dive in, and this is really the chapter that is on truth, text, and belief. So Hans-Georg Gadamer's Truth and Method transformed the way that we think about belief and bias, truth and also conflict. It's a long and difficult book, even by his own admission. It was written in the decades after the war, and he was trying to provide an alternative history of truth. That is, it tried to critically reveal the flawed development of the dominant view of truth that we tend to work with in the modern world, and it sought to suggest an alternative model. What the book achieved was the crafting of a solution to the problem of relativism. This problem had become urgent for Western philosophy, arising simultaneously from different directions of the philosophy of language, anthropology, sociology, literary theory, and indeed religious studies, all were involved in debates that threatened discourse about truth itself. All interpretation had become suspect, and the foundations of communication had become destabilized. So Gadamer offered a key to that problem, a small and reasonably simple key that involved not resisting the problem of relativism, but rethinking and relocating it in a kind of contextual grounding. So he embraces relativism, but he sort of tries to establish the outlines of its limits. And this was of great importance in allowing the humanities to proceed and flourish. I think there was a period in the 80s and 90s when Richard Rorty had written on the Mirror of Nature, he'd written on pragmatism. Derrida had become very much prominent throughout the humanities. And a number of other figures, in Wittgensteinian philosophy, even philosophy of language, even had been seen to challenge notions of truth. And the humanities in general, I think, you know, from sociology across through to philosophy, the more applied and the more theoretical sciences were worried about what it meant that they were doing. It actually threatened the very practice of scholarly interpretation. So his insight allows the humanities to proceed and to flourish. And thus his insights into cultural research and textual understanding were very timely. They countered the potentially debilitating effect of, for instance, Derrida's deconstructive turn, Edward Said's critique of Western attempts to try and reinterpret other cultures. They resonated with the historicism of Michel Foucault, who tries to trace the way ideas develop and change through history, historically embedded. He agrees with this. They fit in many ways with the speech act theory of Quentin Skinner, so in the analytical realm, where speech is reinterpreted not as the conveyance of information, but as forms of expression, expressing certain behavior, encouraging certain behavior. It fits with that. And indeed with the narrative ethics of Paul Ricoeur, who wants to look at how texts change our notions of ourself and of the world. With the existential thought of people like Rudolf Bultmann, who wants to remind people that religious texts are not necessarily about literal interpretations, but rather about a kind of a transformative effect on the self. And indeed the religious phenomenology of Erzsim Kohak and modern anthropology's insistence on participant observation as a way of inhabiting other worldviews. So you don't get to just read the other text of the other culture. You have to go in and live it, let it change you, and try and see it from within. Mm. It's a much more embodied form, a way of understanding the nature of meaning. And we'll see in the chapters to come, Gadamer's ideas go beyond this, even beyond these notions of meaning, into the nature of healthy societies, the ethical value of the arts and education. It shows how this rethinking of truth shapes the nature of human flourishing in physical sciences and mental health, how they remind us that there are alternative worldviews to classical theism, so they fit with a very different way of understanding religion to perhaps the theistic sort of prophetic communication model that you get in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And they offer a whole range of alternative perspectives, even offering a new way of understanding globalism and religious pluralism within society. And that was one of his major concerns in his later years, where he perceived the globalization process as something that could overwrite difference and conversation and try and reduce different cultures to a single voice. And he wants to remind the world that that's neither really possible in the long run, nor is it desirable, and that truths can maintain their complex, differentiated, and constantly changing nature, that in fact that's what a conversation is and should allow itself to be. So, what does he have to say here about truth, text, and belief? Gadamer's insights change language from a reliable, practical tool for grasping the world, which is what people had sought for it to be. You use a word, it grasps a thing, into a volatile personal process of transformation, something that transforms us and the world around us. So it's no longer an object by which we grasp and dominate the world. It becomes a process by which we change. The whole dynamic of power alters in the way that he views language. Instead of turning language into a regularized tool or the object of a science, he wanted to introduce a different way of interacting with language, and to make it available for future endeavors as a landscape for exploration and a material by which we can create new meaning. So it's explorative, it's creative. He asked how it is that language can so mysteriously express our world and shape our identity, alter our values, open up new possibilities. What is the core of language, and what is the limit of language? What can language do at the edges? What can it do if it is harnessed to its greatest potential? So he wants to change language from simply a sort of a tool that we use to interact with the outside world and open it up into something much more complex that changes us, that shapes the world, that makes us who we are, that articulates values and opens up new possibilities. The old correspondence model of truth was deeply embedded in Western ways of viewing language. Most words were seen to correspond neatly to clearly defined entities. The word apple referred to these round fruits that we can see and eat. The word action referred to things that we see people do, etc. Right. It was only a secondary kind of language that slipped away from this basic model. Poetic expression or evocation, commands and stories, for instance, were all odd kinds of language that had to be accounted for, but the most basic kind of language was that correspondence model. The basic function of language could thus be safely envisioned as a set of labels or pointers that are derivative upon the basic building blocks of the real world. Incidentally, these are models that, of course, are highly debated within many other cultures. If you look at, for instance, early Indian debates about how language corresponds to the world, many Hindu and Buddhist thinkers immediately, from a very early stage, question that whole model. Mm. Right? So there's a flower, I say flower, there's a flower, flower and flower, there's a link between them. And that becomes very much questioned in other cultural traditions. But there's something quite intuitive about that once we enter into, certainly into modernity. But this model had always sat ill with religious language, in which commands and addresses, poetry and symbol, discussion of values and stories, all claimed equal importance, So if you look at many religious texts, those sorts of things, poetry, symbols, story, etc., discussion, philosophical discussion, but also value discussion, all of these things rival the descriptive paradigm that had come to predominate. So it's relatively, you get metaphysics, you get cosmology in religious texts where they try to describe a certain set of facts. Mm. But that's not always the case. And indeed, arguably, a lot of religious material does not do that. It prescribes ways of living, it invites you to reflect on certain questions, etc. Already within the Western philosophical tradition, Plato's notion of universals had already raised philosophical problems with the correspondence model of truth. It appeared to question, to answer the question of what it is that words point to with the theory of forms that is expounded in its simplest form in the Republic. But Plato proceeded in later texts, such as the Parmenides, to show the flaws in that very theory. So his early texts, or his sort of middle period texts, seem to set up a notion that words refer to these forms or universals. And later he questions that. He says, wait a second, what are these forms? What are these universals? What are the boundaries between them? Aren't they relative to the position that you take? So the famous model in the Parmenides is that he says there's a tall man, there's a short man. Tallness and shortness seem clearly defined. But if you put the tall man next to a much taller man, he becomes the short man, so that your categories suddenly are destabilized and are relative to the perspective and the context in which you're using the words. So too, Aristotle's Poetics had also questioned the simple correspondence model by hinting at a pluralistic approach to meaning and truth. They seek to categorize different forms of discourse. So Aristotle's texts say truth can take different forms. It can be phronesis, it can be aletheia, it can be techne, it can be poesis, etc. There are different ways to express and to express a kind of a truth. Gadamer had been a student of classics before he became a philosopher, like so many others in the German philosophical world. And these early original provocations that lay at the very roots of the Western tradition were natural to him. Science, the correspondence model had always been questioned. In medieval theology, God had served as the ultimate boundary case of referential language. So you get theologies of the nature of God and language about God immediately push away this very simple natural correspondence model. So theologies of the divine had inspired Aquinas and Maimonides, amongst others, to suggest different philosophies explaining how language might point to an object so elusive that it was beyond the reach of normal descriptive terms. The whole point about the idea of God is that not only can we not see it and use our normal perceptions, but we can actually know that it's, you know, if it exists, it would be an object that necessarily exceeded the boundaries of our normal ideas. Even our concepts would not be able to encompass this object. The result was two philosophies that highlighted the ways in which words can have partial or provisional meanings that remain open to as yet unimagined extensions. So in the case of Aquinas' analogical predication, his view foregrounded the idea that there's a... Aquinas' analogical predication reminds us that a meaning that you give, so God is good, for instance, has to remain open to ways in which you don't even understand as of yet the goodness of God. You know what it means to some extent, but you really have the larger picture. Maimonides, the great Jewish theologian, develops a notion of negative predication. So language's grasp on reality has to be loosened. He says he notices that language can refer to all sorts of things, and in the case of certain objects like God, you can never point to God. There can be no correspondence to the divine object. You can only sweep away inappropriate meanings. So I can say God, all I can say about God is he's definitely not this, this, or this. Not limited, finite, frustrated, small, etc.
Like descriptions of nirvana, for instance.
It's a little, exactly, the negative theological approach to language. So you're not saying what it is, but you can at least. There is a kind of meaning and truth that pushes away the wrong meanings, at least.
Mm.
So in both cases, language's grasp on reality had to be loosened to allow the imagination to open up to other, perhaps unknowable, truths. That theological perspective was given a new impetus by the exegetical turn that was initiated by Martin Luther. Luther's rereading and eventual vernacularization of the Bible invited a new appraisal of the overall goals of what a text is trying to do. His text is not trying to inform so much as to persuade, to challenge, or to alter the reader themselves. It's an active agent and not merely a passive receptacle of facts. The result was a Protestant tradition spanning Bultmann, Schleiermacher, and others, moving on later to incorporate Paul Ricoeur, Don Cupid, D.Z. Phillips, Stuart Sutherland, that sought to reappraise religious text at the level of grand discourse. So it looks at the whole text, not what individual words are doing. The language is an active revelation by which one agent, the writer, the prophet, perhaps God himself, seeks to causally influence another person. And reading becomes a kind of work, a religious work, to sculpt oneself or someone else into something better, rather than a mere catalogue of facts. So again, the power relation is altered here. You yourself are being affected, rather than using language scientifically as a tool by which to influence and affect the outer world. Right, so the environment is changing you rather than you changing the environment. Even the traditions of verificationism and falsificationism applied by people like Anthony Flew to religious texts, which say a text only has meaning if you can link it to particular empirical experiences. So you can show that you can verify it with your experience, and anyone can. You can falsify it. You can show what would make it untrue. That movement also, even in its own way, really consisted in, was really a concession to the idea that meaning concerned possibilities for human experience rather than just links to the outside world. So they say, when you judge a text, go see how it can shape your experience of the world. In the continental tradition, Derrida's ideas, and in the analytic tradition, Richard Rorty's ideas, effectively contributed to this movement, and they put the nail in the coffin of any solid account of truth for many. The potential for meaning to vary, the impossibility of finding a secure pillar or anchor for truth, confirmed what seemed to be the pragmatic, provisional, changing contextual character of truth. So that worked out well. Philosophy and religion had already thus moved from the scientific towards a more literary paradigm. And new approaches were already pushing and pulling at the referential boundaries of words by the time Gadamer got involved in the debate. A new grand narrative of truth was emerging that acknowledged that truth has a kind of ghostly nature. It's very elusive. It's hard to pin down. And a chimerical nature, as it's always changing, has many different aspects, is never the same, but is always in motion. They agreed that literalism was now the enemy, that you take a truth simply to state certain facts that correspond to the world. And this indeed was partly a response to fundamentalist approaches to scripture. So it has a kind of a liberal approach that is counteracting a more literalist and fundamentalist approach to religion. And for theology, in many ways, this worked out well and was expressed in important movements, opening up a fresh approach to religious readers who were in need of some new inspiration. So the idea that the 20th century was a time in which religion sought new inspiration and had a new ethical need to be more liberal in the ways of interpreting texts. This is coming partly out of things like the Second World War, the church's feeling that it needed to respond to religious fundamentalism, Vatican II, which says Islam and Judaism can have levels of truth, other religions can have a certain grasp on truth. All of this fits with that movement in theology, and it offers new inspiration. So texts didn't offer objects called facts. They were theological agents, like little angels and prophets, that painted a picture that was meant to challenge the reader to be changed into a different person. Theology still needed to fight its own internal battle about whether texts should be seen as literal or as, if you like, transformative and active. And that meant that theology needed to rethink its understanding of the true purpose of scripture. Is it revelation or is it something else? What the nature of revelation itself is. But overall, it served well with the purpose of theology to engage with the broader spiritual life of humans in history. But that was theology. For the emerging fields of cultural understanding, anthropology and sociology, religious studies and cultural studies, this shift in truth was much more problematic. And one result of this, one expression of it, was the insider-outsider debate that raged through the later years of the 20th century, challenging both religious and anthropological interpreters to justify their accounts of other people's views. With such a fundamentally unstable account of truth, what was it that explanation sought to convey? Why are we trying to explain another culture or another text to somebody when there's no stable truth in the text and no way in which we can be sure that our version of it is in fact the truth? What is one then doing? What was the alternative if there was no longer a stable truth to convey? A kind of semantic solipsism seemed to be threatening the humanities in Gadamer's time. Each of us sits there with our own interpretation, but we are unable to talk to others or to represent text to another, so scholarship itself is brought into question. And it was to this that he sought to respond in his own formulation of truth. Now, just to see where he comes from in creating that interpretation, it's worth looking to how he himself engaged with texts in his own experience as a scholar. So the education of any young humanities scholar in Germany in the early 20th century, let's say the 20s, entailed a rich tradition of close text reading and dialogical teaching. So there's a lot of sitting around in classrooms, in reading groups, reading primary texts together. And the young Hans-Georg Gadamer was strongly shaped by this training that would teach him the nature of text from the inside out. So beginning his work as a student of classics, as Nietzsche before him had done, doing a lot of reading of Plato, of Aristotle, of the pre-Socratics, of later sources, but very much engaged in a direct reading tradition that shaped a lot of the philosophers of the time, actually. Some of his first experiences were of reading Plato in classes that worked carefully through the dialogues, watching the meaning unfold through the slow excavation of Socrates' community of philosophical inquirers in the text. So the stories are stories about people getting together, and it demonstrates through the story of the dialogue what it means for humans in a community to slowly reveal meaning together communally. And indeed, the same process was going on in the classroom itself as he read these texts about the excavation of meaning in a community. Students and teachers themselves dialogued with the text and with each other to derive fresh readings and new insights. So there's a process going on, both depicted in the text and that you have to go into yourself in order to read the text. Each new insight, so each time a student or teacher offered an interpretation or an observation about something in the text that made people go, oh yes, interesting, that illuminates. Such insights generated new meaning, which is after all the purpose of study, is to generate new meaning. Yet they were not subjective or unrestrained meanings. They had to stay true to their source text, returning to it again and again. So the student says, oh, what Plato's doing is this. And they go, oh, that's interesting, but surely that doesn't fit with what he says here. And maybe we need to alter that. It fits better if we read it in this way. So the creative side is being brought back again and again. What was contrary to the original was something that if someone comes up with something wholly new and it doesn't seem to work with the text, it wasn't something that had to be erased and rejected fully, but you had to admit its innovative nature as a new creative text or idea of its own. So if you say, gosh, what if we take Socrates not as a wise teacher, but as a political revolutionary? You say, oh, well, that works in respect of these particular aspects of the text, although maybe not in respect of these. So you're always contextualizing. What is right about that interpretation? What fits with the original? What doesn't fit with the original? And indeed, if you go very far and say, I think we should only see Socrates as a wild political revolutionary, then you can say that's a very interesting interpretation. Go ahead with that. But let's acknowledge that it doesn't necessarily reflect what the text itself is doing. It's your own new creative text, right, which has its own valid meanings, associations, and establishes a new conversation of its own. So that works, in a way, as long as one is responsible in one's contextualization. The self-reflexivity of these sessions was explicit. Students were encouraged to see themselves as the modern heirs of the dialogical tradition. Socrates' new students are placed into a modern 20th century context. The historical hermeneutics of Wilhelm von Humboldt and later Dilthey that were recommended as a methodological tool for students studying older texts help to confirm this idea that truth can be elusive and changeable when studied across history. And all of this fit very well for many young Germans into a Hegelian understanding of history. Human understanding wasn't supposed to be just a lamp that shines onto the world. It was part of a gradual unfolding of truth as something which is never already there, but is always constantly emerging, is always complex, organic in a sense, and is a process. Outside of the classroom, these approaches to the text were extended into a greater acknowledgement of creativity and innovation in the poetry reading groups that Gadamer attended from an early age. He had a deep love of the poems of Holderlin and Rilke, Hermann Hesse and Stefan George, and others. So he's got the historical text where he has to keep returning to the original historical context, but then you've got the poetic texts, which are much more open. In fact, they're texts that intend to enter more directly into your context, and they're not necessarily calling you to be true to the history at the origin of the text itself. In these poetry reading groups, a cosmopolitan community of men and women, Christians and Jews, he writes in his later work about how those poetry readings were very cosmopolitan. You know, there weren't necessarily many women in his classrooms, but there are plenty of women in these groups. Christians and Jews were, in some cases, supposed to be seen as separate communities, but actually within these kinds of intellectual poetry reading communities, different religions, different perspectives and backgrounds were uniting together in the shared creation of new meaning. So they were interacted creatively together through their sympathies and their differences. So you can differentiate, you can differ about the interpretations of a poem, and that can still be productive and positive. To create new interpretations for the poems, consciously adding to their meaning. So you have a creative role in the poem. The poem is supposed to have an ongoing life, and you're the one who's creating it. There's almost a performative sense in which you become one with the become a new author. The authorship of the poem opens out to include a wider community. So if poetic reading offered an arena of relative unconstraint, and historical reading was fairly constrained, when he moved into becoming a philosophy student, the discipline of philosophy provided a contrarian impetus towards greater constraint. So the logic of deductive analysis, conceptual consistency, ring-fenced this wider range of interpretations. It's the opposite of poetry. Poetry says, go out. Philosophy says, keep coming back, not only to what the text seems to say, but to certain rules of the language in the text that are to do with logical consistency. And this was at work in his classes on Kant and Hegel, Leibniz and Husserl. But here too, the rules of philosophy were at work creatively to reveal the conceptual structures of meaning itself, bringing to light new entailments and novel applications of these ideas. So still what you're doing is interpreting and expanding the text, but just in accordance with much tighter rules. The result of all of this was a dialectical notion of meaning as a sphere in which rigorous analysis and creative interpretation, constraint and unconstraint, were the two sides of a single coin. Gadamer's own history of text reading thus demonstrated for him at first hand, A, the historical relativism of language and the contextual relativism of all reading. B, so relativism is absolutely present, but relative to context and not merely to the individual. Meaning could be discovered not by aligning words with their proper references, but by bringing them into a process of association and illusion, a conversation through which new meanings arise. So meaning isn't about tying little links to the outside world. Meaning is about a process of binding together all the positive associations and illusions of the world of concepts themselves. So you're constructing it out of a cloud rather than tying it to a pre-existing reality. And C, correct truth was the holding of that process of construction true to an original dialogue partner, a person, a text, a culture, perhaps, a particular environment in which you have to interact. So that was what determined the correctness of a truth. And indeed, that correctness, remembering that that correctness is a process and not a single fixed point. So you never get to say, here is the one correct truth. Rather, you're always determining correctness as a relationship to what the other person is saying. As long as you're saying something that indeed does interact with the original context effectively. So the image he uses elsewhere is the idea of a game. You throw the ball, and as long as the other person catches the ball and throws it back to you, you've succeeded in establishing some kind of interaction that is true to the other. Mm. And it's the same with meaning. I throw the ball of a certain interpretation, and if the person catches it and says, yes, I get that, and let me throw it back to you in this new form, then effectively you're in a good relationship, and it's that relationship that is in fact the nature of what it means to be correct. But of course this could only be viable, only remain true in relation to that original source, as an ongoing process. So truth is never finished. It has to continue just as time and context change. So this is the new model. Truth and Method, as a text, sought to give a technical foundation to this model. Historically, he framed his discussion within the historical hermeneutics. Historically, he framed his model of truth within a certain set of different disciplines and spheres of discourse. So A, historical hermeneutics, B, semantic philosophy, and C, the phenomenological tradition that it inspired him. So he's got particular disciplines which he wants to link it to, humanities and history, language, philosophy of language, and phenomenological philosophy. And these inform the different sections of the book, Truth and Method. So it actually, those different spheres, he wants to relocate truth in each of them, and they inform the different sections of Truth and Method. But embedded within the book were also specific little models for rethinking this nature of text, with its altered anchor for truth. One, he links text to the notion of different communities, literally imagining different little villages on a landscape. So each has its own local language, and he links truth to the origins of language in the meanings and values that dominate in each community. Put enough people together in a little group, and in interacting with each other, they create certain patterns that they all understand and that they all share, and that are the basis by which they interact successfully. If you travel into a community, these patterns must be learned. They're patterns of behavior that cohere with local custom. And that's language, but that's not just language. That's also the values of the community. That's behavior, it's how to act, it's ritual, it's habitus, if you like. This he describes as the basis of what later comes to be called taste. And he uses this Latin phrase, the sensus communis, the communal sense, the communal taste, the communal habit, if you like, or ethos. And this is a model that he says gets lost and confused later because it's interpreted in an overly subjective way by Immanuel Kant, who wants to focus on the notion of aesthetic. So he says this communal sense, taste, is no longer about getting the feeling for a community. It's about acquiring their taste in terms of art, and that becomes very subjective in terms of my taste for certain things that I like and I love, and I have a taste for that. But now it's just me responding in a certain way. He says originally it was always communal, it was always contextual. Such language communities are provisional, so they can change. They're only relative to certain areas or regions. They're quite practical. They're embodied and engaged in how you behave and live. They are changeable, right, over time. So new languages and interactions are always emerging. They're participatory. They don't simply pre-exist. Everybody is constantly making and confirming them, right? And actually everyone in the community has the capacity to open it up a little bit. So, you know, a new word in English, the 20th century has seen a lot of this. Google enters the dictionary as a verb, etc. So we're always adding new meanings. But they are not subjective or relative. So a wrong word or action in a certain community will be quickly revealed by everyone's look of puzzlement and confusion by the fact that you completely fail to achieve something. Yet, between communities, one sees links and new possibilities and meaning. It's interesting to think of the person who moves between different communities and has to learn different languages and tastes, and they become someone in whom meanings can have different formulations. So, you know, you can act in this way, but you can't act in that way in the other community. That action means something else. So you're sort of coalescing different tastes, if you like, different languages. And that reminds us that there is this open field of possible meaning, that it's never fixed, and that it's in a sense sort of generative and contextually located. So the reader is, in a sense, always gaining a taste for multiple contexts. The author's context, the author of the text, one's own context, that of other readers. So that's the sort of local communal meaning notion of language. The second model he gives is of text as a form of play. I alluded to this earlier. So he says, look at the nature of plays, of games, particularly, is the easiest example. In a game, you have certain guideline rules for how you can behave for your activity. But you then get to take on these rules and use them in a range of different ways creatively, right? So a game where you simply do a series of actions and then the other person does a series of actions and they're set would not be a game. The idea is that these are guideline rules that say you can do these kinds of actions and the other person will respond, and then you're going to respond to those in a way that works to create some new sort of pattern of activity that the two of you share. So the movement of multiple partners around certain guideline rules for creative activity is what defines a game. As a footballer moves the ball toward the goal that both people have agreed, by established rules that they have agreed, and others then do the same, generates a pattern of activity constituted by all of them. So again, it's participatory. In the same way, the author and each reader takes the words of the text as a set of associative constraints, rules that generate meanings, and these continue to create coherent meta-meanings. So each text creates new, bigger meanings that are shared within that particular group of people engaging with it in any particular context. One class will get something out of a text. Take that context away, a new class that comes in, different people, different associations, and a new meta-meaning is created out of that text. So the text is always generating new texts with each reading, right? In each new text that is created is contextual. And that's fine. That is, in fact, what it is to understand. And the last image that is kind of alluded to is the idea that each text opens up a view of the world. So a worldview model, which has its horizons. And from this we get the well-known phrase, the fusion of horizons, which is the most well-known phrase in Gadamer's work in many ways. But the horizon model is very important. A horizon, so if each text opens up a window, as it were, onto the possible range of meanings, it's important to remember that a horizon is not something that simply ends at a certain point. I understand these meanings, but not those. Rather that a horizon kind of dissipates into the distance. So there's always the possibility for me to kind of glimpse what a different culture is saying, but I haven't yet moved into that sphere yet. And as I expand my horizons outward and strengthen associations in conversation with the new culture, I'm expanding my horizon. I'm, as it were, moving so that my view expands. And the map, my map of the world, in fact, gets bigger, so that I can have ever larger, ever wider, ever more extensive, multiplicitous views of the world around me. Right. So the fusion of horizons, when the text's view of the world and my view of the world come together, create a new view of the world, is actually an expansion of our views. It's an extension of truth itself. Now, it's important that these models of A, travel between communities, B, playing games in new ways with new players, C, of ever-expanding horizons, all imply an ongoing transformative process that alters everyone involved. So when you travel, you change. When you play, you become part of the game and you change. When you expand the worldview, that worldview is your view and you therefore change. And this fact is sometimes ignored, that there's something that is active and personal in this notion of truth. But these technical models of semantic structure accorded well with the move in religion to redefine religious reading as a personal process of self-transformation. So that works very well for Gadamer, who grew up in with his main religious connection being his mother's German pietist tradition. So his father was a scientist and basically an agnostic, didn't reject religion but was not particularly engaged. And he did express a skepticism about literal claims for instance, life after death or miracles. But that didn't bother Gadamer particularly, partly because his mother was religious, she was a pietist, but her view of religion seemed to consist much more in the idea that you read certain spiritual texts that are meant to change you into a better person. So the issue of whether a miracle really happened was really very much a secondary issue, and its the main goal of that assertion would be to change you and alter you. So religion for him thus consisted primarily of a kind of self-sculpting, a self-changing, which is terribly important. On this model, it worked very well to see the text as something contextual, something ongoing, something creative, and something personal that involved personal change, and the creation of new meanings oneself. Right. The media of the new meaning, its substrate of these new meanings that were emerging every time you read the text, is not just language itself or the world or culture or society. The new meanings are happening in the people. Right? It's us who gain these new meanings. And meaning is the nature of our consciousness, so that when you expand our meaning, when you understand something anew, you are changing your own consciousness. So students, theologians, if you like, readers of poetry, and students of religion or of other cultures are living sites of new meaning in which diverse perspectives from other cultures, old and new, meet and play and are involved in this creative game of shared meaning making. So all that we do, in fact, in the area of in the area of understanding, including in the scholarly field, is becoming new meanings, embodying and creating new meanings, which are then shared. It's actually a very Hegelian view. Humans are the constant upwelling of meaning in history, expanding, opening up, branching out into new spaces. Now, that's the core of his representation of meaning, and we'll see in later lectures what that involves for how he then wants to redefine things like spirituality, how he wants to redefine things like the nature of a community, and other topics as well. I just point to the idea that this helps to rethink the nature of religious belief, so that those who want to say my belief is that such and such happened shouldn't be stopped from saying that. That's absolutely important, but one can then rethink what it means to understand what they said, what the meaning they're making from that assertion is. Like, what is it that they are actually, what is the worldview, the horizon that opens up when they say, no, I think he really died on the cross and really came back to life again. What is that meaning in their own life? What does that mean in connection with their culture? What does that mean perhaps in the implicit issues that they're responding to when they make that statement? That people may question whether he died on the cross, that our assumptions about what is possible need to be challenged by a belief in the supernatural, that we should be willing to change our assumptions about the world, that we might want to rethink the narrative of our life as something that goes beyond the event of death. All these different things are meta-meanings that are being created when the person makes that assertion. And that's the real text, if you like, that underlies their particular statement. So you're always unpacking, if you like, what a religious belief itself is. It has this wider picture of the world, a horizon that's opening up around it. And when you then come to respond to a person's religious belief, you are yourself opening up new meanings and trying to understand what they believe. And this is important. This is very much something that accords with a lot of existing views. There's a great quote, Gadamer's, from Philosophical Hermeneutics: the nature of the hermeneutical experience of what it is to understand is not that something outside, the nature of the hermeneutical experience is not that something is outside and desires admission into us. It's not a text that's trying to get into me and then I have it in me and it's changed me. Rather, we are possessed by something, so it doesn't get into us, rather it possesses us, and precisely by means of it we are opened up for the new, the different, the true, So we take it on as a way of seeing, and we then act, and a new way of living, in fact, emerges. And this is an idea that's brought out in a range of different interpretations of Gadamer. It reminds us that one of the primary purposes of truth, one of its primary functions and purposes, is to transform us. So that understanding, reading, scholarship become part of a creative change that we enact, and that we don't always acknowledge in scholarly ideas of study. And indeed, he links this to Plato's account of a person who seeks knowledge. Plato has this great account in Book 6 of the Republic. He says, "The true lover of knowledge is always striving after being. That is his nature. He will not rest in the multiplicity of individuals, which is an appearance only, but will go on. The keen edge will not be blunted, nor the force of his desire abate, until he has attained the knowledge of the true nature of every essence, every idea, by a sympathetic and kindred power in the soul. And by that power drawing near and mingling and becoming incorporated with the very being, these ideas, having begotten mind and truth," so creating mind and truth, "he will have knowledge and will live and grow truly, and then, not till then, will he cease from his travail." So that the desire for knowledge is a desire to change, to grow, to live and grow truly, with the ideas mingling and becoming incorporated into your very being. And the desire to understand is a desire for that to happen. In some ways, this accords very well with Pierre Hadot's notion of Greek philosophy as a personal practice, philosophy as a spiritual practice. So this is what's behind his understanding of what religious belief does, and that accords very well with a lot of particularly Protestant hermeneutics. And it always reminds us to dig underneath the text as well. The texts have different forms of discourse, different ways in which they can interpret. And that the existing or dominant or personal view of what that text means is only one under which we can see other ways for sort of excavating meanings that a text may have had for everyday people, may have had at the time, for communities through history. Right, so it's not that the text meant something then and now it means something to us and we need to capture the right original meaning. Rather, the text, let's say the Upanishads, means different things for all the different communities who've read it. And so we must excavate into a text to capture its innately elusive texture behind the apparent message. This involves meticulous contextualization. We're constantly dialoguing with many different contexts and emerging, bringing out and unpacking this great proliferation of different significances, different worldviews that it contains, as it were. Now, I'll go on in the next class to talk about the way in which this relates to his notion of spirituality. So the idea of that transformative process is something for him that is not merely a side effect of what it is to read and to understand. It's actually the goal of reading and understanding, the way in which all understanding has, if you like, a personal transformative effect, and therefore a spiritual quality. So from his own perspective, something that people don't tend to see as spiritual, reading, understanding, communicating, etc., text itself, is fundamentally located in what it is we are and we want to become as humans. It's what's involved in taking control of your own change through time and wanting to craft yourself through that interaction into something new. So we don't merely happen to become who we are through history. In an informed sense of understanding as a creative process, we're able to shape who we want to become through history. And that, for him, is going to be central to what it is to be spiritual, to engage in the spiritual project that every human has at their core. Okay, I'll leave it there.